Hi, my name is Bill. I'm a drug addict. And I also suffer from a disease called alcoholism. I thought there were going to be like 20 people here. You guys do a spaghetti dinner just right. That's very cool. First off, Lewis, thanks for the telephone call. And whoever, you know, decided that you wanted me to come up here tonight and stand in front of you is an awesome honor. And I thank you for your persistence and your reminders. Thank you for that. Tina, thanks for hosting the meeting. MC and taking care of the readings and things. Lewis, you forgot one thing on the anniversaries. 24 years for a group. 24 years for the candlelight, for the Sundays, what's it? The Sunday Night Strength Candlelight meeting, right? That's a pretty awesome achievement, 24 years for a group. My home group. Well, let's start from the beginning. As I said, my name is Bill. I'm a drug addict and I'm an alcoholic. We got that part done. My home group is Opportunity Rocks. We meet Thursday night in Aurora, Illinois at Mercy Center Hospital downstairs in the Buckley Room. It's a closed meeting of Cocaine Anonymous. The group is 12 years old. I was there for its inaugural meeting when that group started. My sobriety date is March 24th, 1998, and I'm grateful to God for that. That's my only sobriety date so far. I hope it stays that way. Kelly, thanks for kicking this off. Life does take on a new meaning today. You know, I'm a garden variety alcoholic and drug addict. I'm no different than each and every one of you who are members of either one of those fellowships, Alcoholics Anonymous or Cocaine Anonymous. We all have a story to tell. And it's not my job in this format here to tell you how to recover. From the sounds of the countdown, most of you know how to do that. And congratulations to those of you who have sponsors and have been introduced to the 12 steps and work those things in your life. Congratulations. What I've got is my story, you know, and it's not a great story, but it's mine. I was talking to my sponsor before coming up, and because that's what I do now. I have a sponsor, and I talk to him. And of course, I'm anxious about coming up here and not knowing what to say. And, you know, you never know how these things are. I never know how these things are going to roll out. And he reminded me that I've had, I'm 58 years old. I've had 58 years to perfect this story. So if I don't know it, nobody does. What am I worried about? And that's pretty much the truth. That's the truth. It's my story. I went to a meeting yesterday morning. I go to a big book meeting on Friday mornings. And it's in the basement of the same hospital where my Thursday night home group is, and it's right next to the cafeteria. So I go into one of the cafeteria to get a cup of coffee first before the meeting to bring back in the meeting, and there's only like a dozen of us in this big book study. And as I'm going in the cafeteria, one of the members of the group is standing at the cashier, and she's checking out. And I say, "Good morning, Cappy," and she said, "Hi," and I noticed that she's engaged with the cashier, and the cashier's just, you know, he's being polite and talking to her, smiling, or having a little chit-chat, and I go get my coffee, and, you know, 45 seconds later, I come up to the cashier, and he doesn't smile at me. I got a resentment. I can't figure out, what did I do wrong? How come he was smiling and talking to Cappy, but now he's just looking at me like I'm just some Jamo? I suffer from alcoholism. I do not deal with life in a healthy way. You know, I've been given a way out today, but the truth of my experience, the divine truth of my experience, is that I've got an incurable disease, and it lives between my ears. I wish it didn't. You know, I wish it were different. I wish I could tell you a story that, you know, I have become something completely different after being sober for 15 years and working the steps and being of service and sponsoring guys and going to meetings, reading. I wish I could tell you that I'm a different guy today. The truth is I'm not. The truth is I still suffer from this thing between my ears. You know, it wakes me up in the morning and it puts me to sleep at night. That was me. I'll stop doing that. I never planned on getting sober, you know. I never thought of sobriety as an option for my life. It just, I don't know, it just never came up in conversation, for one thing. Sobriety, it just, I started drinking. In Illinois, they changed the drinking age to 18 when I turned 18 for beer and wine. It was 1 month after my birthday was when the drinking age changed, and I was in college at the time, and I thought it was the best thing that could possibly happen to me, because here I was gone away to college, and it was legal for me to drink at school, and I quickly discovered that I was a lot happier in the Metropole playing longboard with the old-timers than I was happier there than I was in class, and I was drinking 25-cent hams on tap at Bingo's, and it was just a perfect life for an 18-year-old in central Illinois at the time. A year later, I was arrested for a couple of drug possession charges, and the school decided that they didn't want me to come back the next year. I was pretty much okay with that. You know, I'd learned how to drink regularly on a day. I was drinking regularly. I'm a quick learner, but I'd been introduced in my first 30 days of school to marijuana. I didn't smoke marijuana in high school. Drank just a little bit, but I had been introduced to marijuana and White Cross speed. We used to do all kinds of speed back then. That was one of my favorite things. Did my first hit of Orange Sunshine. That was followed by several hundred more hits in a short progression. I mean, I jumped right into a culture that I had absolutely no experience with. And it really seemed for the first 18 months or so, there were no consequences. And that was, well, it was a great experience for me until, you know, the sheriff decided that, you know, he was going to hook me up with a couple of possession charges, like I said, and I didn't get back to school. It really worked out okay because I'd met my future wife already, and I figured I really wanted to get home and start making some money, so I dropped out of school and I came back home, which is Aurora, Illinois, and I got a job. got into the trades. My dad was an electrician, and I knew I wasn't going to be in the trades, but as it turned out, I showed him I became a carpenter, which I thought was appropriate. And I ran in, hooked up with a group of guys who were pretty much just like I was. You know, we were pretty rough and tumble. We liked to drink. They liked to do the same kind of drugs I did. I was working in a panel shop. We built prefabricated homes, and moved up the ladder fairly rapidly, and they made me foreman of a second shift crew. And there were like 8 or 10 of us on this second shift crew, and it was a pretty good time. We worked real hard. We got our quota done, and come 8 o'clock in the evening, you know, we'd sit out on the bunks of studs outside and watch the sunset and pass the joint around. And one day, one of the drivers came in late, and he saw us sitting there doing that. And what do you know? The next day, he went and told the superintendent. And the superintendent said, "Bill, you know, I'm going to have to fire you, and all the guys that you got working for you." So he fired the entire crew, myself included, and I got to tell you, man, I had a resentment. I had a resentment. And I nurtured that resentment for a long time. I figured out how I was going to pay him back, what I was going to do, how I would, you know, sneak over to his house and slash his tires. And I never did any of those things. I didn't do any of those things, but, oh, I drove myself crazy with the thoughts of how I was going to pay. You know, I got married, had a son, turned into this blossoming alcoholic and drug addict. I was introduced to cocaine. It was in the 80s when it was pretty trendy back then. You know, it was real, real expensive and kind of difficult to get a hold of. I liked it more for the cachet than for the buzz that it gave me. But, you know, I got to know some people. I guess that was one of the key things that happened. I was pretty much a shot and a beer guy. It's really where I was at. You know, I'd go to the bar after work, and I'd have that shot and that beer with the guys, and then eventually somebody'd say, "Hey, you want to try some of this?" And, you know, it was either off to the bathroom or out to the parking lot to do that little bitty knife blade tip. This is cocaine. And I remember just wanting to be a part of that culture and wanting to be involved in all that. You know, my career shifted a little bit. I stayed in the trades, but one job led to another, and I ended up working for a company and advanced right through that rapidly, became a foreman for that company, and had some great successes, ended up hiring some drug dealers to work for me. You know, that's a pretty good deal when you can pay a guy, when you can use the company money to pay a guy to come to work, and he doesn't come to work, and then when he does show up, I mean, the creative things that we do to get high. Thank God I've had an opportunity to make amends for that stuff. That's part of what I did to get high. You know, I thought it was just normal. I thought what I was doing was just normal. From the guys that I hung around with, that's what they did. You know, they drank, they did some drugs, they went home to their wives and carried on with life. And that was all I knew. And I'm going home to my wife after these what used to be occasional, you know, a couple hours after work that turned into be, you know, 11 o'clock at night, or, you know, getting off work at 3:30 in the afternoon and coming home at 11:30 at night, 12 o'clock at night, pretty messed up, was not high on, well, didn't make my wife a very happy person, let's put it that way. She wasn't real pleased with me. And there was some discord at home, you know? Bill, why don't you stop this stuff? And I had a son that was, you know, witnessing his dad doing this kind of stuff, coming home late, and the cocaine addiction, the cocaine use increased to where, you know, I'd be gone for a couple days at a time with his son at home, wondering where's dad. Mom would say, I don't know. I don't know where your dad is. My son was 13 years old when I finally got sober, and that was in 98. So the formative years of his childhood, let's say from 5 till 13, that 8-year span, was when I was in the worst part of my disease, the horror. And as things got worse and worse, and I had no clue about what you guys talk about, obsession and allergy, and all I knew was my experience with it was, I went out and I intended to, you know, $100, that was it. I'm just going to buy this little bit, and I'm going to be home, or I'm just going to get this teener, and I'm going to be home. And I intended that time after time after time, and that was my plan. And I did not realize that I had no ability whatsoever to see that plan all the way through, and I had no idea that what happened last week was guaranteed to happen again. I could not see that. It's hidden in the front of the big book. Could not tell the truth from the false. Had no idea what was going on with me. And my life began to spiral, and depression crept up, and sure, I felt like crap, because I was raised a good kid. I did not want to hurt the woman that I loved more than anything in the world. I didn't want to hurt that little boy that, geez, he had a daddy, I was a dad. I mean, I didn't want to hurt those people, and I knew the difference, and I felt crappy about that. I really did. So I got hooked up with a counselor, one-on-one, you know, and I went to see her because I was depressed. And that's the truth, I was depressed. It was the first person I was even a little bit honest with, and how dare her, I'll never forget. She said, Bill, I think you're a drug addict. And I said, my God, really? And you're probably an alcoholic too. And I went, whoa, wait a minute. Wait, whoa, back it up. And it was at that point that I acquiesced a bit. And I said, you know, this cocaine has become a bit of a problem in my life. It really has. You know, I'm spending money that I shouldn't. You know, I'm not able to keep my word anymore. It seems as though my truck's got a mind of its own, because it just goes right. It just did. I said, yeah, you know, what can you do for me? Can you help me with this cocaine stuff? And she said, well, I think you may be an alcoholic too. And I said, there's absolutely no way. Maybe I do drink a little bit too much, but it's only because I'm doing too much cocaine. She said, well, here's what you can do. Why don't you go to an open meeting? And she suggested, go to an open meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, what's that? She explained it to me. And I said, well, there's no way I'm going to go there. What if I see somebody, right? I can't do that. Well, it'd be a good place for you to get this book, and this book's called Alcoholics Anonymous. You might need that book. I said, well, where else can I get it? She said, well, you could go to Borders. They sell it there. And I thought, no way. What, am I going to go buy this at Borders and go up to the counter and, you know, buy a book called Alcoholics Anonymous? I'm not going to go through that. I really didn't have any desire to get sober, to change anything. I did maybe want this depression to go away, and I'd come to maybe look at the fact that I was doing more cocaine than a normal person should do. I was having problems. I stopped going. She kept making these appointments, you know, come in on Thursday, come in, and I'd blow these appointments off. And finally she said, Bill, you know, I hope you get the help you need, but I need this time slot for somebody else who really is looking for help, so I'm going to have to set you free. And she did. She pretty much told me to go. And I did. And I stopped going to the little counseling thing with her, and I went back to doing what I did. And the disease is kicking on me now. This was probably in 95, 96 when I went to see this counselor, and the disease started kicking on me pretty hard. And I'm spending money I don't have. I'm selling things that aren't mine. My mouth is moving. I'm lying. I'm a train running through the lives of everyone that I know. I was sitting home one, I don't know what day it was, pick a day, Tuesday, call it a Tuesday. My wife was gone to work, it was springtime, kind of like this. I'm sitting at home and I'm getting high in the kitchen because that's the safest place for me to get high. I found this little place. My kitchen's kind of a U-shaped kitchen, all right, with the peninsula counter that comes out. And there's one spot at the bottom of the U, if you will, where I found a spot back there where I could sit on the floor in between the cabinets, and the tile is cool, really cool down there. And I got this cool tile and all the lights are off and the microwave is up here and I can look in the microwave and I can see the reflection of the TV and I can see out the slit in the patio door blinds, right? And I've got my place, you know, I'm sitting there and I'm doing what a little drug addict does. I'm holding my little bag of cocaine and I got my little, and all of a sudden I see smoke and it's hanging up in the kitchen ceiling, like, and it's hazy up there, and I'm thinking, oh, geez, this is not a good place to be right now. I'm pretty messed up, and all right, I'll go find this. Something's burning. It's probably nothing major because I don't see any flames. So I finally get up from my little quiet spot in the corner there, and I look around the house, and I go upstairs, and I'm looking in the bedrooms, and I can kind of see smoke hanging above the door jams in each room, and jeez, but where's it coming from? I go outside. I finally get up the courage to walk outside. I put some clothes on because we don't wear a lot of clothes when we're in that state, you know. I'm sitting there in my underwear. Anyway, I put some clothes on and I go outside and I look over the ridge of the house and by God, from the vents, the roof vents, I can see little wisps of smoke coming out. I go running in the house and I run upstairs trying to find the source of it, and I don't see any fires. There's no flame, but I'm a carpenter, and I have tools, and I know how fire likes to get inside wall cavities and travel along. So I grab my sledgehammer, and I start wailing on the drywall, and I'm pulling drywall down, trying to find the fire, and I can't find it. So I go back downstairs, and I'm still, geez, I know there's smoke here. Oh my God, what am I going to do? There's no fire. I can't just let the house burn down. You know, my wife's going to come home. Last thing she wants to do is come home to a house of rubble. I finally got the courage to call 911. And I called 911 and said, listen, this is probably not an emergency or anything. Do you think maybe you could have one of your firemen or somebody stop by on the way home and just, you know, come in and just put my mind at rest here? Well, they don't respond like that. Within a matter of minutes, here's, you know, the squad cars, the paramedics, the fire trucks, and these guys come charging in the house. There's, you know, six or eight firemen come full gear with it. They come charging in the house and they go charging upstairs where all the drywall's pulled down, and they turn around one by one and they walk out, and the fire chief is the last one out, and he looks at me, and and he looks at me and he just shakes his head and he says, you know, before you beat the shit out of your house next time, why don't you call us first? Because there was no fire. There was no smoke damage. It was just complete manufacture, complete hallucination. And at that point I had gone around the bend. Those of you who have been there, you know what I'm talking about. Complete, utter insanity running in my life. I truly can no longer tell the truth from the false. The hallucinations are a part of my reality at that point. They went on their way. My wife's coming home pretty soon. I thought, oh, this is not going to be good when she comes home. And I remembered. I said, you know what? I know what I'll do. I'll call AA. Because this counselor lady had said, you know, I might need, you know, might want to get hooked up with AA. And so I got the phone book out and I called the hotline and was waiting for the call back, and my lovely wife came home and she said, yeah, so what else is new? So what else is new? You tore the house up. And I said, yeah, but it's okay, honey. I called AA. It's going to be all right. And you know, later on that evening, I did get a call back from a guy. His name is Bruce. I've never met Bruce. Bruce was a volunteer, you know. Remember, I worked the hotline in Naperville, Illinois. He called me back and suggested that I might go to a meeting that night. And I said, no, I don't think so. Not tonight, but I'll go tomorrow. And I actually did. The next night, I went to a meeting. I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And they gave me a big book. And I couldn't believe that they gave it to me and they didn't make me pay for it or anything like that. The group of guys signed the inside of it, and they took me, and they did a first step on me. And I went back to a few meetings. So over the course of the next couple of weeks, I actually went to a few meetings. Maybe six meetings in 2 weeks. And I kept a little journal at this time, too, a little log. You know, I'd go to a meeting, and I'd come home, and I was drinking and still using, but I kept a log. I only used a 16th today, two beers, not too bad, pretty good day. And I was, you know, figuring, might as well keep score here because that's probably what this is about. Nothing changed. Nothing changed. Things went from bad to worse, from worse to extreme, from extreme to unbelievable. I came home a couple years later. It was in March of 98 when I came home. I came home from a run. I'd been gone for the weekend, and I don't know what was different. I don't know what happened to me this time that hadn't happened to me a million times before, but when I walked in the door that day, and I walked into the bedroom at 7 o'clock in the morning, I was just done. I'd hit that, I'd been given that gift. That gift, the gift of desperation. I understood what hopeless and helpless was. I mean, I hadn't been taught that, but I was experiencing it. I was alive with hopelessness and helplessness and just utter degradation. And I walked in and I keep talking about my wife. Her name is Ellen, and I got to back up real quick and say, I didn't say thanks to Ellen, but you know, thanks for putting up with this shit for all these years. I'm grateful to you. Thank you for that. Every time I get a chance to share, I find it's part. it's part of this continuing amend that I need to make to those that I love more than anything in the world. I need to continue to make these amends. Anyway, I went in and said, Ellen, I need some help. And she said, yes, you do. And she threw the phone book on the bed and said, I'm going to work. And turned around and walked out the door. You know, I'm grateful because at that point she'd learned how to take care of herself. You know, she'd suffered from my disease, this family illness too. She'd suffered from that long enough and up to a point that she could no longer suffer from it. And she turned her back on it. And she turned her back on my disease and wasn't going to let it kill her as it was killing me, and I'm grateful that she was able to do that. So she went off to work, and I was in this place of utter desperation, and I picked up the phone, and I started calling around for treatment, for help. You know, I didn't know what I was looking for, didn't know, not a clue. You know, I mean, I'd been up at 3 o'clock in the morning like the rest of us, and you see that, the little ads on TV that, you know, this is your brain on drugs, but I didn't know how to get, you remember those ads? Some of you do. Okay, all right, there you go. Some of you do. I called this 1-800 number, and a woman answered, and I didn't know where she was or anything, and I started telling her that my brother needed some help, right? Because I don't even have a brother, right? but I started this little tale, just, you know, testing the water, and after a few minutes, I was at a place where I went, oh, geez, you know, it's not for my brother, it's for me. And she said, oh, really? Okay. Like she didn't know, right? But then she started asking me some questions. She said things like, do you spend more time looking out the rearview window when you're driving, rearview mirror in the car than you do out the windshield when you're driving? And I said, yeah, I do. But when was the last time you took a shower? And I went, what, are you here? How do you know? She started asking me all these questions that, as I understand it now today, she was offering her experience to me by asking me questions. Questions that she knew based on her experience. She'd been where I was at. Now I understand that. At the time, I was amazed. I was amazed that there's someone else out there who felt like I was feeling, who'd obviously been where I'd been. She she suggested that, you know, I follow through with this action and get hooked up with their treatment center. I found out it was in California or somewhere, and I wasn't going to go to those kind of lengths. But I did eventually end up in a treatment center. I ended up in a local treatment center. I need a drink. Ended up in a local treatment center, and I went for my intake thing where they interview you. I was convinced they were going to have to lock me up, that there was no way they were going to be able to let me go home. But those who were there seemed to know what they were talking about, and they said, no, we're going to do this outpatient thing for you. You come in here in the evening every night for however long. I said, there's just no way this is going to work. I'm going to get high going home. I just know I'm going to. He said, well, we've got another level of care. If this one doesn't work, we'll bump it up another level. Let's try this. And I guess this guy who did my intake saw something in me that I didn't see at the time, and that was desperation. And that was a willingness that I had. So I started going to this outpatient thing, and they made these suggestions that we go to meetings and stuff. And they didn't really care what kind of meetings, as long as we go to meetings. And I told my counselor, I said, you know, I went to some AA meetings a couple years ago. I went to six of them, and I didn't like them, and I don't think it's going to work. So that's why I'm here. Why don't you guys do for me what, you know, the insurance company's paying for, and don't tell me to go to meetings. And my counselor was wonderful. He said, okay, Bill, that's fine. Have a seat. And he didn't tell me what I had to do. He didn't try to cajole me or twist me or anything. So I didn't go to meetings. And I'm sitting there in group after a couple of weeks of group, on Mondays, they pass around the sheet, and everybody fills in, anybody been in treatment, they fill in the sheet. How many meetings did you go to this week? How many times did you call your sponsor and that kind of stuff? And these people in the group are getting a lot of attention, and I'm not getting any attention. I'm feeling kind of let out, because... So I decided, I look at the sheet, and this guy went to 6 and 4 and 2 meetings. Well, if I can, I'll go to 10, you know? If they're going to 8, I'll go to 10. And if they're going to 12, I'll go to 14, you know? And I started going to meetings, and the truth is I started going to meetings for all the wrong reasons. I started going because I wanted to be, you know, teacher's pet in treatment, because I got this messed up ego. I got this, the absolute truth. Somebody tell you they're going to the meetings for the wrong reasons, screw it. It doesn't matter. In my experience, it doesn't matter. I went for all the right reasons, as far as I can tell, because it seemed to work. And my experience is that within a couple weeks of doing that, of going to 10, 12, 14 meetings a week, within a month or so, I don't know the exact time, but there was a period where I was standing in the shower, and I was getting ready to go to my evening group, and God did for me what I can't do for myself. God removed this obsession. Did I work any steps to get there? No. Did I know what was wrong? No. Did I know how to fix it? No. My experience was that there was a moment of clarity. Out of sheer and utter desperation came a moment of clarity where I knew, in this weeping, bawling, crippled human being, a state of being, I absolutely knew that it was going to be okay. I didn't know if I was going to use again or if I was not going to use, but I absolutely knew it was going to be okay. Was it a spiritual awakening? I don't know. I don't get into semantics, but my experience is true in that God did for me that moment what I couldn't do for myself. And like I said, I started going to a boatload of meetings. I went to well over 500 meetings my first year. I didn't leave a meeting without knowing where the next meeting was going to be. That's the truth. And one of the coolest things about it was that people started recognizing me, you know, and my eyes came up off the floor. After a while, they'd go, hi, Bill, it's good to see you again. And nobody had said hi, Bill, to me for a long time. And I hadn't been able to get my eyes up off the floor for years. And I actually started to like going. And I started drinking coffee. I love that shit, too. When I was in treatment, they had me tested for Tourette's. They thought, I was really, this is a gospel. I'm a real cocaine addict. I was so twitchy and so fidgety, I was physically offensive to be around at meetings. I mean, people would not sit by me because I'd just start doing this. I'd start talking. And so they did. They actually tested the council, thought maybe I had some kind of form of Tourette's or something. I may. They don't seem to think I do. But. So I got a sponsor right away. My first sponsor, his name is Tom Freeman. Tom Freeman's an old alcoholic from Arkansas. And Tom Freeman wouldn't mind me using his name. He told me I could. And Tom had been sober 22 years when I asked him to be my sponsor. All of Tom's t-shirts are sleeveless. Not that there's anything wrong with that. All of Tom's t-shirts are sleeveless. He wears suspenders and an Arkansas Razorback ball cap with a union pin stuck on the side. And Tom's a good old boy. And I'm not Mr. Urban or anything like that, but there ain't that much country in me. You know, I'm really, there's not. Tom and I are not a lot alike. He's never done a lick of cocaine in his life. He'd done those little reefer smoking and stuff, but when I met Tom, he had that undefinable something about him. He had something in his eyes, something that I had absolutely no experience with. He was alive. He was happy. He was joyous. He was free. He was a demonstration of what God's will is for us. And I was immediately attracted to that, and I just wanted to know, how do you do that? It was, Tom, how do you do that? How? Tell me how. And he said, we'll work on that. We'll do that. Why don't you come on over to my house? We'll just talk about it. And Tom started me off on a journey through the steps. He made all kinds of crazy suggestions, too. Like, he wanted me to take his storm windows down and help him paint them and stuff like that. I understand today he was trying to be of service to me in those things. Of course, I had to paint my own storm windows and stuff. And I love Tom Freeman. You know, he started this journey for me through the steps, and he told me that it was okay for me to help people right away. I hadn't worked all 12 steps, and I had people coming up to me to ask me to sponsor them. And I'm going, wait. And I go to Tom, this kid over here wants me to be a sponsor. And old Tom says, look, you tell him that I'm your sponsor, and that you obviously have something he wants, Bill. So why don't you go ahead and try to help that guy? I mean, before I'd worked through the 12 steps, he was letting me know that I could be of service to others. That this was a place where God could work. I just need to let God in. So I got a service position right away. I was going to a noon group at a club in Batavia, Illinois, and I volunteered to make coffee. I don't know why I did it, but I didn't know how one of those bun-o-matic coffee machines worked, so I had to ask somebody how they worked. You know, I had to be taught. Here, the filters are down here, bum bum. You put in 3 scoops, not 4, not 2. You put in 3 scoops. You get in, and I didn't know how to do that. I had no experience with the bun coffee maker, but I'll tell you what, just like that, I'm the coffee guy. I got a job. I showed up every week and made coffee, and I kept my eye on that coffee pot. You know, during the meeting, you know, if it's getting low, boom, I'm up. I'm going to make a bill. But I instantly felt a part of. Before you know it, the gal who was GSR of the group said, you know, Bill, I can't make it to the district meeting. Or she said, I can't make it to the district meeting. Would someone like to go in my place this weekend? And I said, well, that sounds kind of cool. I'll go. What is it? And I didn't have a clue, you know. But before you know it, I'm GSR of the group. She just kind of walked out, you know. She needed somebody to take her place, and I guess I was it. So I became a GSR, and I got involved in the service structure, and led to a position, to the next position, involved in the area, and you know, my service experiences from coffee maker to a delegate from the Illinois area, and most of the stops in between. In this last 18 months, I'm coffee maker. I have no service position whatsoever, other than coffee maker again, and I'm really grateful for that. Where are we going to go here? I said that I was part of starting a new group, and it was 12 years ago that we started a group. The group Opportunity Rocks is the name of the group. Started at a halfway house. And CA wasn't real big in the Fox Valley where I'm from. There weren't too many CA meetings. But I was sober a couple years, and nobody told me that I couldn't start a meeting. So I rounded up a couple of buddies and said, hey, what do you think? Let's start a CA meeting at this Opportunity House, this halfway house. And they said, sure, yeah, I'll come for 6 months. And I was only sober a couple of years, and I didn't know anything really about starting a meeting, but I jumped into it. There's not a lot of long-term sobriety in CA in the Fox Valley, where my meetings, most of my CA meetings are. And I'd settled into a place where I was going to like three CA meetings a week, and then two CA meetings a week, and I wasn't going to any AA meetings, and I was doing all the service work over here, and I was in pretty good shape, and I had a sponsor, and I used to call him, you know, every day, and then I used to call him every week, and I used to call him once a month, and it had been months since I'd called him or since I'd seen him at a meeting, and I'm going to a couple of meetings, and I got all this service stuff going on, and I'm getting sick again. I'm starting to get sick again, you know, and I was never threatened by the. I was obviously threatened by the option of picking up another one, but I was getting really sick again. You know, I was restless, irritable, and discontented. And I ran into a guy at a different meeting, and I was talking about it, and he basically challenged me. He said, "So how long are you going to stay like that until you do something different?" And I looked at John. And I said, "So fine, will you sponsor me?" And he said, "Hey." Of course I will, but I'm not fishing for sponsees, but of course I will be honored to help you. So it was at that point that I'd gotten too well, you know. I'd gotten too well. I was going to these meetings where I was the elder statesman, you know. And I had all these service things, and all the questions were coming to me. And I didn't have anybody to go to. I didn't allow myself a chance to be right in the middle where I need to be. I'd become some kind of a spearhead of something that I have no business being the spearhead of. And I realized it wasn't healthy. Now, I didn't come to that conclusion on my own. That was a gift from God. The pain of my existence was once again coming back to bite me. So I changed sponsors, and I have a new sponsor now. His name is John Grady, and he wouldn't mind me using his last name either. I'm grateful for John in my life today. I've been given a new opportunity to experience these steps in a different way than I had for the first 12 years of my sobriety. I've come to a new understanding of the first step. I've come to have a new living relationship with the first step and the truth about who I am. And for that, I am absolutely grateful. You know, I was confident, I was convinced that if I could just get this obsession and this allergy and this, if that could be dealt with, that life would be okay. And in some areas it was, in other areas it wasn't. You know, the hospital coffee guy didn't smile at me. You know, I'm crazy. I don't think right. My son called. he's been married for a few years now. He's got a lovely gal. They've got a condo in one of the suburbs, and he doesn't call as often as I'd like him to, or as often as I'm sure his mom would like him to. He doesn't keep in contact like we would both like it. And he called the other day, and it was engaging with Easter, involved with Easter and stuff. It was quite a while back. But I was upset because he was going to go with her family and we weren't going to be involved. And I got this little attitude, this little chip on my shoulder. And, you know, I'm a little pissed off. He owes us better than that. He should treat us better. And I'm thinking all these things. And I talked to my sponsor about it. And he reminded me that what was my job? It was to raise my son to love his wife. And that's what he was doing. He was putting her needs first. My God, what a wonderful different perspective. I'm unable to see that perspective on my own. I, I just don't. Maybe some of you guys work this up different than I do. I don't know. But I just don't. You know? I need the input of others. I know that solitary self-appraisal seldom suffices. You know, I cannot. I do not have the ability to have an objective perception of myself. You know, my thinking comes out and it crosses paths with my character defects, and before you know it, I'm off over here. And when I'm off over here, I believe the shit that I'm telling myself, and it doesn't have to be true for me not to believe it. And if I believe it, I have feelings about it. Before, if I have feelings about it, I'm going to take action on it. And it's all because I'm believing what I'm telling myself. If I could stem those character defects from interfering with my thinking, well, then I'd probably be okay. That's not been my experience, though. That's not my experience. My character defects, you know, we were talking, those character defects, those wonderful things, and the opportunity to take a new attitude towards those is about the best I get to have with the sixth step. I get to have a new attitude, and I can take those defects to God in the seventh step, and the hardest thing for me to do is to maintain an attitude of willingness to have them removed. It absolutely is the most difficult step that I work today, the sixth step. My ongoing experience with the 12 steps, much to my surprise, seems to be all wrapped up in the first three steps yet again. It absolutely is. 95% of my problems today can be solved when I'm living in the truth of the first step. When I'm living in the truth that the fight is fixed, that my thinking is the source of the problems. When I live in that truth, instead of trying to think my way beyond it, 95% of my problems vanish. The other 5% of the problems I can apply the second and the third step, and they're usually gone too. This really is a simple program, and I've brought my thinking into it and fought with my thinking over the process of working each and every one of these steps. Gesh, and I've been a big book thumper. You know, I've used the big book like a machete when I should have used it like a scalpel. I've used the 12 and 12 the same way. And I love both pieces of that literature. I absolutely do. They're clearly divinely inspired. And every guy that I work with, guess what? They work through the big book and through the 12 and 12. It's been my experience. I'm standing here today a sober man because God continues to do for me what I can't do for myself. That's the truth. Those promises as they're laid out in the ninth step are the truth of my experience today. I didn't have to work through all nine steps to get to that promise either. In fact, even when I'm not working the 12 steps, God continues to do for me what I can't do for myself. I'm alive today because of God's grace. I didn't experience God's grace for years, but it was because of His grace that I'm alive today. The difference is when I'm applying the principles of the 12 steps, when I'm surrendered and relying upon God, it's at that point that I get to have some of that happy, joyous, and free that Tom Freeman had. It's at that point that I can be comfortable in my own skin. It's at that point that my wife can look at me and not want to kill me for being such an asshole. I'm never really good at wrapping things up. We have a quiet time before every meeting. We typically start a meeting with a quiet time. And I've got a little prayer that I say every time there's a quiet time, and I'll just share it with you. It's what I say at every meeting. It's what I say each and every day of my life. And it's, God, let this healing continue in the divine order and as always for the highest good. And with that, thanks for letting me share.